boxes, right?
Oh, yeah.
Well, what is it also?
Yeah.
So when we can.
No, we go.
Okay.
Sister, she's really cool. She speaks Spanish.
Better watch her in Spanish.
She really spoke very well. Had like a conversation.
Christian's like, wait there, and they were like,
Do you want to spend the 30 on it?
He was just throw it away. Oh yeah, I would actually like someone here.
You're the vanguard.
Yeah, I'm the vanguard.
My friend once said, Vanguard is right here,
okay,
but inadvertently pointed to
Jesus. My name is Chris Metzler.
Bad
I'm the moderator for this event. We have Josh Decker from the International Bolshevik Tendency to speak about his organization and then answer any questions that you, the friendly audience, may have for him. So we'll begin with his introductory remarks and then we'll move to the floor. So thank you and please welcome Josh.
Thanks, Chris, and thanks to Platypus. What is the International Bolshevik Tendency? Our predecessor organization, the Once Revolutionary Spartacist League, has answered that question by writing that the IBT is, quote, a vicious gang of crazed, God-failed renegades, eager to serve the purposes of those who would like to destroy us. Elsewhere, proclaiming that garbage doesn't walk by itself, the SL wrote, quote, mainly the BT is a highly dubious and potentially extremely dangerous pest of the Cointel prototype, unquote. Trotsky was subjected to worse slanders by the Stalinists, and of course Lenin was characterized as a hireling of the Kaiser by the Social Democrats. So we're in good company, I think. Of course, to properly answer the question, what is the IBT, a bit of history is required. Between 1951 and 1953, the Fourth International was destroyed as a liquidationist current headed by Michel Pablo declared that there was no point in building independent revolutionary proletarian parties and that it was necessary to burrow deep inside reformist and alien class formations in an effort to push them to the left. Opposing this adaptationist current was a loose grouping organized into the International Committee, the IC, whose principal components were the USSWP, led by James P. Cannon, the British SLL, led by Jerry Healy, and the French PCI, led by Pierre Lambert. Now, Cannon's SWP, which had benefited from close collaboration with Trotsky before his assassination, was perhaps best positioned to lead the fight against Pavlovism. Yet his performance was marred by parochialism and a rightward drift, which within 10 years led it to reunify with the Pavloites on the basis of a shared, uncritical enthusiasm for Fidel Castro and his petty bourgeois guerrilla movement. Opposition to fusion with Pablo was led by Tim Wolforth, James Robertson, and the Small Revolutionary Tendency, or RT, which was highly critical of the liquidationist policy of the Dobbs leadership on Cuba and also towards the pacifism of the civil rights movement. Wolforth broke with the RT, which was periodically expelled from the SWP and emerged as the Spartacist Group in 1964. Now, the Spartacist League struggled not only to preserve revolutionary continuity, but also sought to regroup with the best elements of the ostensibly Trotskyist milieu internationally on the basis of a program that restored the revolutionary vigor and consistency of the early Fourth International and addressed the changed context of the post-World War II era, in particular the need to unconditionally defend the new deformed border states, Cuba, China, North Korea, Yugoslavia, and so on, while fighting for proletarian political revolutions to oust the ruling Stalinist bureaucracies. Most people, I think it's safe to assume in this room, are familiar with the SO only in its highly degenerate form. Yet the Spartacist League of the 1960s and 1970s was a very different political animal. dozens of self-sacrificing young communists from the decomposing New Left, whose self-confidence and energy were rooted in a deep understanding of the Trotskyist program, which through the pages of the Works Vanguard and other high-quality publications was applied to the burning questions of the day. This included paying special attention to the oppression suffered by women and blacks, without giving any political support to petty bourgeois tendencies such as feminism or black nationalism. The Spartacist League was the only organization on the US left to warn against the class collaborationism of the Chilean Patriot Front, and it was also alone in calling for opposition to both the Shah and Khomeini in Iran in 1979, while defending all neocolonial countries against imperialist attack. During the Vietnam War, the SL opposed the pacifism prevalent in the anti-war movement and sided unambiguously with the Viet Cong against US imperialism. While many left groups in this period worked inside the unions, they tended to engage either in sectarian antics or opportunist maneuvering with out-of-office bureaucrats, sometimes combined with amorphous rank-and-file groupings. By contrast, SL supporters sought to build programmatically based caucuses by using Trotsky's transitional program as adapted to the particular situation. In some unions, SL supporters built a real base, which was reflected in impressive levels of support in union elections. By the mid-1970s, Spartacist trade unionists initiated labor actions, helping launch workers' defense guards in a couple of cases, and in several unions, longshore, maritime, and communications, had become recognized as the leftist opposition to the national bureaucracy. We detail this work in our 1998 edition of the Transitional Program, which is available on our website. Now, tragically, this work fell victim to the process of bureaucratic degeneration experienced by the Spartacists. Even by the early 1970s, the SL had become a somewhat harder organization than it had been in the 1960s. Results of bitter factional struggles and the departure of older cadres, particularly Jeff White, who had, as peers of Robertson, helped to offset his inclination to what he liked to describe as his angular approach to politics. Yet the hardness of the Robertson school at this stage was still within the acceptable parameters of Leninist operational norms, albeit at one end of the spectrum, with Cannon's SWP located somewhere near or at the center. As working class militancy in the US receded by the late 1970s, however, Robertson's outlook began to change. Seeing the prospects for revolutionary breakthroughs evaporating and unmatched in authority inside the International Spartacist Tendency, or IST, Robertson increasingly began to focus on shoring up the dues base of the organization and eliminating potential challenges to his leadership position. The hardness of the earlier period began morphing into something far more disturbing: political cultism. A whole layer of cadres, among the best and most independent-minded in the organization, was purged in the late 1970s and early 1980s. Increasingly bizarre accusations, often with sexual overtones, were hurled at targeted comrades, who in some extreme instances were asked to demonstrate their loyalty to the organization by resigning from it. The highest profile purge, in this case of Bill Logan, took the form of an elaborate show trial replete with hysterical denunciations and a verdict that found the accused guilty of, quote, crimes against communist morality, unquote. Around this time, Robertson began to liquidate the group's trade union work, as he feared that comrades with even a small base in the labor movement were potentially dangerous to his unquestioned authority in the party. The few comrades who refused to tear up these precious toeholds in the workers' movement were predictably driven out of the group. Although the IST was exhibiting some signs of political gyration, its formal commitment to a revolutionary program was a source of great confusion by the victims of Robinson's bureaucratic purges. And so no internal opposition formed to oppose the transformation of the Spartacist League into what it is today. Yet a handful of ex-members, after leaving the organization, sought to make sense of what had happened to them and what was happening to the International Spartacist tendency. In 1982, a group of former Spartacists in San Francisco and Toronto came together to form the external tendency of the IST, or the ET, subject to many jokes in the early 1980s. You were asked not to phone home. Aiming to be reinstated as an oppositional tendency inside the IST, the ET at this time characterized the SL as a degenerating but still revolutionary organization, as a quote. The ET raised a number of political criticisms, focusing in particular on the liquidation of the SL's trade union work and the effective abandonment of internal democratic centralist norms in favor of bureaucratic commandism and personal loyalty to Robertson. A key difference emerged in October 1983, when a group calling itself Islamic Jihad blew up a U.S. Marines barracks in Beirut, killing 240 imperialist troops. The ET said that this was a defensible blow against imperialism, while Workers' Vanguard infamously called to save the lives of the remaining Marines. Many SL cadres did not like the Marines alive position, but by that point the SL had become so bureaucratic that no internal opposition to Robinson's social patriotic dive emerged. A year later, in November 1984, when the SL actively attempted to sabotage an 11-day docker strike in San Francisco against South African apartheid cargo, an action initiated and led by our supporter, Howard Taylor, the ET concluded that the SL's process of degeneration was essentially complete. While a few comrades from the Spartacist milieu came over to us as a result of the SL's shameful wrecking, there was once again no internal opposition to Robertson, demonstrating that the group was, for all intents and purposes, dead as a revolutionary organization. Shortly afterwards, the ET renamed itself the Bolshevik Tendency, the ET. And in 1986, the first issue of our periodical, 1917, was published. Meanwhile, in New Zealand, Bill Logan had been active in the ultimately successful struggle to decriminalize homosexuality, gaining national prominence as a key figure in the gay rights movement. He and former IST cadre Adair Hanna eventually put together the Permanent Revolution Group, PRG, which grew substantially before and after it entered and was then bureaucratically expelled from the New Labour Party, a left split from labor. In 1990, following intensive discussions, the PRG and BT fused and soon merged with a group led by former Spartacists in Germany called the Group for International to form the International Bolshevik Tendency, or IBT. Today, the IBT has sections in the US, Canada, Germany, New Zealand, and Britain, with supporters in a few other countries. In 1986, the BT had fused with a small group in the San Francisco Bay Area on the basis of a platform called Four Trotskys, a general programmatic document we still use today and which we've translated into eight languages now. For Trotskyism was published in conjunction with our theses on Solidarność, which firmly defended the Polish deformed workers' state against the CIA and Pope-sponsored Solidarność. In August 1991, when capitalist counter-revolution triumphed in the Soviet Union, we were virtually alone on the left in calling for a military bloc with the Stalinist old guard, who were desperately trying to save the status quo against the restorationists led by Boris Yeltsin. Though we asserted that a proletarian political revolution to overthrow the Stalinists was the only way to truly defend the world's first worker state. We are a very small organization. Over the past three decades, the IBT's greatest achievement has been to survive as a healthy, democratic centralist group cohered around a consistently Trotskyist program. The period has not been easy for revolutionaries. It has been marked by a regression in class consciousness, the ascendancy of neoliberalism, the restoration of capitalism in the Soviet bloc, the retreat of many nominal Marxists into postmodernist and other academic fads, the revival of anarchism as a default ideology for radicalizing youth, the war on terror, and so on. We have held our ground. Our founders have managed to train younger cadres, and the organization, while small and fragile, embodies key lessons of generations of the class struggle. Now, we do not claim that the IBT will organically grow in size to become a mass revolutionary workers' party. Rather, our perspective is one of regroupment with leftist elements of other groups via a process of splits and fusions, as we say. By providing a pole of attraction for individuals and groups of militants seeking a genuine revolutionary program, the IBT is a necessary but not a sufficient condition for the crystallization of a revolutionary proletarian vanguard. One of our main tasks as a tiny propaganda group is to publish serious commentary and analysis of questions of historical and contemporary importance for the workers' movement. We are not capable of covering every major issue that arises, and our focus is on quality over quantity. Our two main publications are 1917, our English language journal, and Bolshevik, our German language journal. We also bring out a French edition of 1917. While each appears only about once a year, which is wholly insufficient, this is supplemented to some extent by postings to our website and by occasional leaflets and pamphlets. Our objective is to function as a fighting propaganda group. In other words, even at this stage of our development, we do not content ourselves with producing Marxist analysis of events, but seek to intervene in the real struggles of the oppressed. Naturally, we must be highly selective about what we spend our time doing. We actively intervene in demonstrations, labor support rallies, and other activities where we distribute our literature, carry placards and banners, and introduce slogans or chants designed to intersect where people are at politically while connecting their concerns to the general problems of capitalism and the need for workers' power. We attempt to seize whatever opportunities present themselves. I noted earlier the entry that our New Zealand comrades made in the New Labour Party. That tactical entry was modeled on the work of the Trotskyists in the 1930s with the so-called French Turn. In the mid-1990s, our British comrades entered the Socialist Labour Party, a left split from Tony Blair's New Labour. In both cases, the maneuvers were relatively successful. Over the years, we have also initiated and participated in many United Front actions with other groups on a variety of issues, including the fight to free Mumia Abu-Jamal and to oppose imperialist attacks on Iraq, Afghanistan, and so on. In some cases, these United Fronts have involved organizing demonstrations of hundreds of people. In others, they have been for film showings and public meetings. We have been guided in this work by our desire to further the process of revolutionary regroupment by cooperating with opponent organizations on questions we can agree on, while also taking advantage of the chance to raise our differences and criticisms. We have sought to intervene in the organized labor movement. In essence, we inherited our trade union work from the Spartacists. Essentially, this was our work in the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, the Dockers Union on the West Coast. I mentioned the historic 11-day labor boycott of South African cargo in 1984, led by our comrade Howard Taylor. We also carried out a similar, though more limited, action 2 years later, which helped cement our reputation in the Bay Area as a serious, hard-left organization capable of translating theory to practice. More recently, our Bay Area comrades have continued to be active in labor mobilizations initiated by former SL supporter Jack Heyman, whose work in the Dockers Union represents something of a continuation of Howard's work, which itself originated in the SL-supported Militant Caucus. Jack has initiated several important labor actions, including the May Day 2008 shutdown of every port on the West Coast in protest of the war in Iraq, the only strike in history by U.S. workers against an imperialist war waged by Washington. I want to show a video, actually. It contains footage of the 1984 anti-apartheid strike, as well as a strike in 1987 that our comrade Howard also played an important role in organizing and leading. There's also footage of the May 8, 2008 port shutdown, and you see Jack Heyman speaking as well.
Pushed out. It's like if you were in California and people were pushed out on the Mojave Desert and put in tent shacks with no way to grow food and no way to live, and they die. Every minute in South Africa, a child under five on the average dies of starvation.
I've been aboard this ship 3 times, and I work any other. Matter of fact, I was in the gang that discharged the Australian cargo. We have no quarrel with the people of Australia. We have no quarrel with Ned Lloyd Lyons. We have a quarrel with the South African government.
Got the blood of the courageous youth in Soweto that stood up against the vicious, racist, apartheid regime.
See, in this administration of this city, we're passing paper resolutions against apartheid, then using the police force to remove people and workers who are trying to strike an economic blow against that regime.
It was a longshore courage in deliberately violating the Taft-Hartley law and the union contract that made that successful.
2,000 longshoremen walked off the job at 11 this morning. The walkout was quiet enough, but by mid-afternoon there was an angry protest. Rita Williams reports.
As they left their jobs, several hundred longshoremen gathered here at the port of Redwood City and set up a picket line. The Inland Boatmen's Union is on strike against Crowley Maritime, the owner of the barge here at the port. In sympathy with the boatmen, longshoremen have agreed not to unload any of Crowley's barges. That's why they got upset when members of other unions, you can see in this shot, started working longshoremen's jobs unloading cans of pineapples. About mid-afternoon today, longshoremen could stand it no more, and they stormed the barge. Some stopped along the way to pick up sticks and rocks, even sledgehammers.
The scabs aren't going to work this barge. That's all there is to it. Our jobs, our lives, and everything else is on the line.
This will stop any job.
Port officials called police, and the stevedores kept moving. It looked like a scene from On the Waterfront. By the time the longshoremen reached the barge, no workers were in sight. So some of the longshoremen took out their wrath on a tire and the truck the containers were loaded onto. Crowley Maritime official told us the whole action today was illegal, that it was a secondary boycott.
Was it worth it? No comment.
Workers' rights, to oppose the war, bring home the troops, stand up for what you believe in. That's what we got going on, and I can't say it no better than that.
We all know about the struggle in the 1800s for the eight-hour day, which was a very important struggle. It was a struggle for safety, it was a struggle for survival, and it was a struggle for working conditions here in the United States. Here in the United States, workers have been struggling a long time, and it seems like now, brothers and sisters, we're struggling harder than ever.
I asked the New York Times reporter last week, will you be covering this event? And he said, is it newsworthy? What do you say, is it newsworthy?
Stop the war now! Stop the war now!
While we are today too small to undertake systematic work in strategic unions, our comrades conduct themselves as good class struggle militants in the unions to which they belong. At times, this has gone beyond being picket captains and the like to organizing militant labor actions. One of our comrades led a teacher's walkout in New Zealand over the heads of the union bureaucrats to protest education cuts just 2 years ago. The Trotskyist program, which the IBT has played a unique role in preserving in living organizational form, is the distillation of generations of experience in the class struggle. We believe it addresses all the fundamental questions confronted by revolutionaries in the modern era. Imperialist war, mass unemployment, erosion of democratic rights, the struggle against racial and sexual oppression, and the need to defend and extend the gains of the working class. In each particular struggle, the intervention of Marxists is shaped by a single overriding imperative, building a revolutionary ideological and material bridge between capitalism and the first stages of socialist destruction. Central to this project is winning over those who would rid the world of capitalism to the struggle to build a Leninist vanguard party. The IBT preserves the Trotskyist program because it is by mobilizing workers on the basis of that program that we can change the world.
Thank you. Current time is 5:10. We were supposed to start convening in the lobby around 5:30, but maybe we could spill over an extra 10 minutes to give an adequate 30 minutes for Q&A. So everyone, please try to be short and succinct with your questions, and we'll start with the gentleman over there.
Thanks. So, as someone who, for Platypus, to a large extent consider himself a sympathizer to a large extent of the Spartacist League and actually followed a lot of these debates, and I read your literature on the Spartans and also the internationalist group, which you didn't mention, is another split from the Spartans. I guess I have to say two things. I mean, I accept that your narrative, your bureaucratic generation, and so forth, the Spartacist League is correct, but it seems to me there's a fundamental difference in the narrative between the split, the origins of the RT in the early 60s, vis-a-vis Socialist Workers Party, which you alluded to, and the BT and the IG in the 80s, because particularly the BT, it seems to me that one, there was a clear set of programmatic issues. It was clear what the politics of the RT were on issues of fundamental issues, aside from just the organization of the party and question of inter-party democracy. The issues surrounding the BT seem to be fundamentally a criticism of a lack of inter-party democracy in the Spartacist League. I mean, if you're an outsider and you read the polemics, not the factual question of who did what in the strike or whatever, which I'm not going to comment on, but the actual lines of difference between the BT and the SL on Afghanistan and the Lebanon attack, they seem rather theological. to be honest. They seem like that the political principles have been magnified by both sides to speak to organizational issues. The first time I encountered the BT was in the 1990s. And it was in New York, and I think it was at the Seymour Mandela thing right after that. And I spoke to some people from the BT, and I asked them what they said about the Sparse League, and they said, oh, we consider it a reference. And I have to say that sort of immediately I thought, like, anybody who considers the problem of the Sparse League that they're reformist must be crazy. Like, you could say many things about the Sparse League, but I find it hard to believe that anyone could sort of seriously consider them reformists. And that sort of disqualified the BT in my mind, and sort of I didn't really pay much attention until the BT, unlike the Spartacists, is willing to work with Platypus, and whereas the Spartacists, they just denounces us and won't even appear on our panels and denounce us from the panels, because that would be unprincipled.
Wrap it up a little bit.
So my question is, isn't there some problem with this narrative? That isn't the narrative of sort of the political degeneration vis-a-vis the Spartacist League and treating it like a replay of issues with the Socialist Workers' Party or the origin of Trotskyism vis-a-vis Stalinism? It seems to me that something else has happened.
Would you like to respond?
I can take maybe a few more questions, and then I can respond.
Okay. All right, cool. So in the sake of trying to keep everything in mind, please have short questions. So I saw Nate had
yeah.
his hand raised.
Well, actually, very, very, very similar question, so I'll just sort of throw it out there, too. I mean, again, I've read some of the sort of, like, I've read some of the polemics, not a lot between, like, the Spartacist League, you know, IG and IBT. And, you know, sort of listening to it here, I mean, without, like, again, I, you know, with Richard, it might have been restraint. For me, it's just total ignorance as to, like, the sort of, a lot of the facts as to this. So not sort of, I'm not sort of looking for justification with that one way or the other. What I'm interested in, though, is that, yeah, the way that it, that this sort of split was characterized is that it seemed to me not to take a sort of explicitly political form with respect to something like how to interpret the transitional program or something like that. And now that split may still have well been very necessary. I mean, if the things you said are true, then that's obviously like cause for like a lot of concern. I wouldn't like, you know, pretend otherwise. But what I'd be interested in hearing is if you could reflect on, you know, what do you think it means that kind of degeneration at the level of organization in your account of the Spartacist League didn't take a more kind of explicitly political form in terms of the split. And, you know, what does that mean in terms of your current strategy of regroupment via splits and fusions? Like, how would those be more principled, or how, you know, could they be? That would be my question.
Do you want to wait, or do you
think I can come in?
Well, let's start with the first two, since
okay.
they're similar.
Yeah, okay. Just to answer Nate's question. It's true, I think that it's part of the self, or it's really the self-conception of the Spartacist League. Robertson was able to cohere this group really around being the hard left, the orthodox Trotskyist organization. It wouldn't be the first one, of course, that such a group would then veer off in an overtly revisionist direction, but that wasn't the self-conception of the group. And I think that his strategy for holding on to this dues base was to cut people off from the outside world and say that we are the party, we are the party of the Russian Revolution, we are these, you know, this orthodox Trotskyist group. So I think that helps explain why we don't see more, or we didn't see more of a programmatic departure. That said, I want to come back to Richard's point, say that in fact we did see elements of this. But one of the first things we noted in the Declaration of External Tendency was that the first real departure from Leninism on the part of the Spartacist League was from from the regime. You know, healthy democratic centralist regime. That was the first departure from Leninism in practice, and it was the framework in which subsequent political departures occurred. Partly what that means is that the SL of the 1960s and 1970s couldn't have made the kinds of mistakes we saw in the 1980s and after from the Spartacist League, or certainly they would have been corrected by a membership that would have revolted against the leadership, which was really impossible by the mid-1980s. Some of those, and so I don't think it's a theological dispute we're having with the Spartacist League, it's a political dispute. And so we see this. One of the early things that the Spartacist League did was walk around with the flag of the FMLN and other, they named them a contingent, an anti-fascist contingent, the Yuri Andropov Brigade after the Soviet premier. So we saw wobbles like this. But more substantively, we saw the social patriotic dive on the Marines Alive position. We saw the departure from class struggle in the trade union work that the Spartacist League had built up over the previous decade. We also saw, and we analyzed this in detail in our pamphlet, Whatever Happened to the Spartacist League, a tendency towards Stalinophilia in the 1980s. And we documented that at the time. But we also see, going in the other direction, Stalinophobia as well. So in August 1991, they are neutral in that conflict. They refused to side with the Stalinists because they had gotten burned in the DDR, in East Germany, by sucking up to the Stalinist bureaucracy. Barbosin wanted to meet with some of the top leaders of the Stalinist apparatus to brainstress them, I suppose. So we see all kinds of programmatic and political differences. But the framework was provided by the SO's de facto departure from Leninism, which really made it impossible for us to be in that organization. On the SL being referenced, I don't think we've ever characterized them as that. Maybe one comrade made a misformulation, but we've never, that hasn't been our characterization. They are a centrist group that is really, it's a political bandit operation. You see mostly sectarianism on their part, and I don't have to give you examples of that. But we also see, from time to time, opportunist dives. So, 2 years ago in Haiti, they were supporting the presence of imperialist troops in Haiti. That's another example of that.
Right, great. Did you want to ask your question? And then we'll move to Pam afterwards.
Benjamin's comments quite appropriate. I've got a lot to say, obviously, and I'll keep it to one particular question. It pertains to this question of a departure from Leninism. Throughout the talk, as a good idea in that sense, you constantly stress the question of internal democracy, right? So you say there was a time when the SL had a healthy, robust internal democratic regime. I want to pick up on that because a couple of questions spin from that. When would you locate, for example, the turn of Leninism and Bolshevism to restricting discussion and debate over tactical and strategic issues to inside the party? Because it strikes me that you can, right, certainly up until 1918, probably beyond, you get manifestations of open polemical, of an open polemical nature, right up with Brest-Litovsk and the factions down there, etc. And why, and I think it comes, I haven't read Trotsky systematically now for about 3 or 4 months, but I think it comes from Trotsky against Schachmann, when he actually says, it's about internal democracy. Right? And why do you think that is the case, and why would you then see it as Leninism in that sense to not actually return to the question of open political factions, and public discussions in your publication, in your on your website, etc., but stress the internal side? Because I think there is a, and it comes up now with, again, this is the whole 1912 thing, all this stuff. I think there is a conceptual problem for us today in understanding Leninism. Right? And I think that most of the far left today either base themselves on a kind of Stalinoid conception of Leninism and iron discipline, justify their expulsions and all the rest of it, like Robson, that's it, on that basis, or that a very highly militarized party in extreme conditions of civil war, where the Bolsheviks were actually forced to say, enough with public factions, we need to actually hold out in the face of the onslaught of the imperialist armies. So I think what I want to draw out in that sense is, why is it Leninist to insist on internal healthy democracy, and why isn't it Leninist and Bolshevist, in that sense Bolshevik, to actually say that Bolshevism is characterized by open public debate and factional struggle? I'd just be interested in that.
Okay.
Did you want to ask your question?
Yeah, it's different. I wanted to ask you a very straightforward question. Like, what is Trotskyism?
That's great. Okay, let's have an answer.
Okay, well, what is Trotskyism? Trotskyism is the Marxism of our day. It's revolutionary Marxism. We don't look at Marxism as a family of different tendencies. Obviously, there can be differences within a Marxist framework, but we look at the concrete tradition of the Trotskyist movement as the sole continuator of the tradition going back to Marx and Engels and through Marx and Engels to Lenin, the Third International, and then the Fourth International. So we see Trotskyism as a comprehensive program for changing the world based on the experience of 150 years of class struggle. What are the lessons of that class struggle? We don't have to reinvent the wheel. We think that many of the key, in fact, really the essential questions have been posed in history and have been answered one way or another by experience, and that those who have remained Marxists have drawn the conclusions and sought to build organizations that embody those lessons in order to intervene in the real world and to change it.
So is it about, I mean, this will be the last, like, just quickly follow up. So, because you talked a lot about the transitional program, mm-hmm. and I imagine that what you mean here is the document that was a response to a particular experience, and thus Marxists, to the extent that they consider themselves Marxists today, should really take this experience in hand and say this is a document that was born out of like struggle and thinking. So is it today then the question is of implementation and not, I mean, is it just an issue of execution?
Well, I mean, there are new questions that can arise or tricky questions, but we think that, yeah, the basic lessons from, and not just the transitional program as a document, but a whole set of documents and, you know, so we base ourselves on the first four congresses of the Comintern, the major documents of the Fourth International under Trotsky and so on. Trotsky's transitional program was really a distillation of the Bolshevik experience and the experience of the Comintern in that early period. In fact, we even find the expression transitional demands used in early Comintern documents. But that methodology and key elements of that program are ones that we stand on today. And so in that sense, it is about implementing this program, but of course, that has to be done in a creative way and based on a particular situation.
Like the absence of a labor movement.
Pardon me?
Like the absence of a workers' movement.
Well, there is a workers' movement that exists. It's dominated by bureaucrats and reformists. We're speaking with the trade unions. They still do, because we don't agree with the World Socialist website, for instance, that the unions are simply bourgeois institutions. These are working class institutions. Their ability to fight the capitalist class is hindered by the dominance within them of bureaucratic class collaborationist elements. So, again, we can draw on the lessons of the experience of Trotskyism and particularly the transitional program as a guide for action. Ben's question. Partly we're going to have this discussion tomorrow, I suspect. But it's partly a function of the size of the organizations we're talking about. You're talking about the experience of a mass revolutionary Communist International with millions of members. That's a different kind of thing than building a propaganda organization. So I think we see I'll just leave it at saying I think we see the difference in approach between CPGB and the IBT. We are trying to build a programmatic-based organization that can actually speak with a coherent voice to the outside world. That doesn't mean stifling internal discussion. Far from it, we have a very dynamic internal organization.
Just nobody knows about it.
Well, you have to find an organization, but that's not stopping us, I think.
No. More military party. Okay. I did do a draw distinction, so, but yeah.
I have a very brief, specific historical.
By all means, and I want to make sure. Okay, very good. All right, Richard, brief. No,
my brief is specific. So Robertson and other leaders of the RT came from the Shacknais, who then, as Shackney moved to the right, joined the Socialist Workers' Party before they were in the RT. But I'm curious if, in your view, Robertson and the leaders of the RT brought into the Spartacist League any particular influences from that Shakunine tradition, and if so, what?
Yeah, I believe on the proletarian military policy, I believe they criticized the SWP, and we think that that was correct. The idea that the trade union should control recruitment into the imperialist military, I think, was mistaken policy on the part of the Canning group. And that is a criticism that Robertson did take from the Shackleton group, so that would be a concrete example.
What about in terms of internal life or other culture or any other differences?
I don't know of any way that would be true, exactly. I mean,
just curious.
Robertson always thought of himself as a Canaanite, really, and you know, we do too.
We have a question from the gentleman over here.
I got a couple of answers, actually. Two other things they imported were the position on at what point the Kuomintang was hegemonized by imperialism in World War II, and the typeface for the masthead. Apart from that, it was a fairly clean break. It was pretty easy, because Sharman was going so far to write. What is Trotskyism? I think that Trotskyism is really only the continuation of Leninism through the struggle of Trotsky against Stalinist degeneration. I mean, the commentary, and that's why Trotsky made a big point of the first four congresses, and as Josh said, the whole idea of transitional demands. In fact, the Comintern passed a resolution to write a transitional program for the fourth Congress, and it, for various reasons, didn't happen. And so Trotsky's writing a transitional program really was, he's just taking things and putting it all together, a coherent program that was derived largely from the experience of the Bolsheviks and largely finds its roots in the documentary record of the Comintern. In our book on the transitional program, which is online, we trace a substantial amount of that. I think if you were to put Trotskyism in a nub formulation, though, it is that the exploiters and the exploited have nothing in common. And that is, there's no possible reconciliation between the interests of the working class and oppressed people and capitalists and oppressors. And that's the red thread that runs through. You know, the Stalinists always find popular fronts or moments to vote for Obama or moments to vote for some, this capitalist is a little better than that one. The Trotskyists are distinguished by saying they have nothing in common. Back to Richard's original thing. I think that, and, you know, I was one of those who was purged from the Spartacist League, so this is a lived experience for me. But, you know, it's a lived experience for dozens of other people, too. We put a great deal into that group. We did whatever we were told. We pulled up stakes, moved, got a job, quit a job, you know, all kinds of things. And it was a significant layer of serious people who, and we were serious about revolution. We were serious about that group, and we were solidly one to it. And we knew that it was Robertson who had, more than anyone else, led it. He had enormous authority. And yet there were things going on, you know, but the political coherence of the organization and the devotion to the pristine quality of the logic of the program is what allowed people to not want to believe that something was happening that was happening. The other thing was that Robertson was very cognizant of what had gone wrong in Cannon's group as far as he was concerned. That was that Shackman had taken out a lot of the best writers. And the Canon group was never the same again. He was never going to let that happen. And his strategy, and it was progressive, and I personally witnessed it, and it is documented in our Road to Jimstown, was a progressively deeper and deeper search into the organization for potential deviations. And everyone learned from that. So you just didn't open your mouth about stuff unless you were talking to your girlfriend or somebody you could trust. And Robertson became aware of that, and so it had to go deeper and deeper. And eventually, he, as he was making a turn, you know, there was stuff going on too. They were buying a multi-million dollar building and, you know, symptoms of a group that had, was changing its quality. When I first met Robertson, he was on an allowance of $5 a week from the group. They paid his rent, they paid his food. And when I left the Robertson group, he had $10,000 that he could spend however he wanted, and every day the treasurer's job was to replenish. Not that he spent $10,000 a day, but, you know, his girlfriends would get mink jackets. And that wasn't exactly right.
Can we start to wrap it up?
Okay. The problem is that we understood, and why we formed the ET was that destroying revolutionary cadres and destroying the trade union work, destroying the hard-fought connections of the working class, that is a programmatic question. You're destroying the revolutionary movement. But it took a while for it to have programmatic manifestations. However, I would say that defending and regretting defeats for imperialist interventions in the Third World, that's not a trivial question. That distinguishes communists from social patriots. I would say celebrating and marching around under the name of the butcher of the Hungarian Revolution, Jure Andropov, who had personal responsibility for crushing the Hungarian workers' political revolution in 1956, to us, that's not a trivial question, as Trotsky's. You know, these are marching around under the flag of a popular front for a Trotskyist organization, the FMLN. That's not a trivial question for us, as Trotskyists. And you know, Haiti, and there have been millions of things since. So I think that I'm happy with our record programmatically.
Right. Now, I see there's other people in the audience that may not be necessarily stewed onto this particular history, so I was wondering if anyone else had any general questions for Josh about the organization or Trotskyism or Marxism in general. Anyone? Well, I guess we'll go with Nate again.
Well, just because something earlier, actually, in my question, which was, the other point I made, and I there were several questions on the table, so I understand why that didn't get directly addressed, was that I asked, is there a way in which the IBT sort of incorporates its understanding of this history in terms of how it approaches its goal of trying to sort of regroupment via splits and fusions. You know, in other words, that if sort of all the, if there was sort of the split from the Spartacist League and this sort of this sort of history that occurred in the interim, and that, you know, perhaps sort of after the fact that split gained other sorts of programmatic sort of valences, but how do you sort of incorporate that history or is there a way in which the IBT strives to incorporate that history in terms of how it currently approaches its larger goal of sort of regroupment? That was, yeah.
We'll take one more.
Sure, okay. I confess I'm not going to ask an intrusive question. I'm a supporter of the IBT by default. I would say a couple things. First of all, absolutely, the experience of the Marxist, Leninist, Trotskyist left absolutely informs our day-to-day activity. I mean the experience of the founding cadres of the ET in terms of seeing how the organizational question can manifest itself as a political question clearly has implications in terms of, for example, like how do we engage in political debate with people disagree with us, or how do we approach a political discussion? Clearly, the increasing bureaucratism and kind of commandism of the Spartacist League has produced a certain behavior where absolute loyalty is the prerequisite, as opposed to thinking for yourself and understanding things. We want people who have read the history. We want people to understand it on their own terms, to critically assimilate it. You're not going to be able to go to a worker in a picket line and explain to him why this tactic's better than that tactic, if you haven't yourself learned the lessons of class struggle history. That's what we want to train people. We want people to look at the Minneapolis Teamster strike and see how a group that's smaller than the number of people in this room can lead a general strike in a city which changed Minneapolis from an open shop town into a town where you didn't fuck with the Teamsters. Because, there are certain lessons, like, Shackman, Cannon, etc. They were trained in the healthy internal regime of the early Communist Party in the United States. They learned, they went to international conferences, and when Josh talks about the documents of the World's Four Congresses of, International. We're not talking about like how everybody's sitting around a table and voting on the motion. Yeah, that's a good idea. No, that's a good idea. No, these guys sat together after participating in mass class battles, right? And they could see, like in France, they tried this tactic. This tactic worked. Like, when we barricaded the plant, or we had a bunch of guys in a truck that could mobilize to go around to different factories to shut it down, that was effective. So you integrate that into the general sense of tactics and strategies that the organization embraces to push for the strategy, which is to put the working class, the oppressed, in power, change the society. So, I mean, I just simply say, yes, does this tradition inform how we behave today? Absolutely. And that video was a small example.
All right, we only have 3 minutes for Josh to respond. Is there any other questions out there?
3 minutes.
Oh, Lord. Well, you were going to take Ben to do a question, and then you can ask him.
We have 3 minutes, we can take questions.
You know, we're going to Exchequer after this. If you join us there, you can continue this.
Okay, yeah, so perhaps this could work, go all night if you guys have any energy. So please, hold on, let's answer these questions, and then what I'll do, answer briefly to these two questions.
Okay, so I'm not going to add much to what Paul said in response to Nate, other than that concretely, and I meant to mention this point that Richard brought up, the IG obviously factors into this as well. The IG, the Cadres were purged from the Spartacist League in 1996. We have sought to engage a dialogue with the IG. They don't want to talk to us. Insofar as they have acknowledged us in their press, politically, we have taken them on, and we've, in my opinion, of course, won those exchanges. I might say that, of course. So I think our analysis of the Spartacist League, in some sense, or rather, our existence in the 1980s as a thorn in the side of the Spartacist League leads the IG, its leadership, Jan Noren, and others, to not really want to touch us because they have a different sort of project at this point. We actually want to talk to those people, but they don't want to talk to us.
How would you? I'm sorry.
Yeah. Hold on, Richard. We have a new question.
What do you think it is about these organizations that sometimes leads people to prioritize loyalty to the organization over like the principles of revolutionary Marxism?
Yeah, probably a guy like Tom, who was involved in the degeneration of Spartacy, can answer that more concretely. But I would suspect that self-doubt, devotion to a project, you've committed yourself, you've committed years of your life and effort into building something that really was important, really was unique and different and made a difference. And to see that slowly slipping away and not being entirely sure exactly what is happening. So are you going to, on the basis of some self-doubt, seek to break from what you've built over the past 10 years or so? That's a very difficult leap to make. And I think that the experience of our founding comrades really only became clear to them after they were with a group and could talk to one another more openly about what had happened to them.
That's a good question. Richard, and then Ben, you had a question too.
Yeah, my question is, would any of the people in the room care to speculate on the future of the Spartacist League after that?
Glorious.
That's actually, that sounds like a very good bar talk. So I think we have a question over to Ben.
Yes, if I may, I kind of evaded the question because I'm certainly not talking about mass organizations per se. That's Mandelism. Mandel basically argues that once the distance between the party or the left and the class is closed, then we can have open democracy and healthy organization. What I'm talking about is actually the foundation of Bolshevism, of the RSDLP, was premised precisely when this group of emigres was scattered across the country and scattered across Europe on an open press under the conditions of Tsarism. Yeah? That is Leninism. Right? And this is where the kind of thing about the red thread stuff that links Marx now. It's quite clearly not. There are all sorts of breaks and discontinuities. We have to look to draw the best from the past and to put it forward in today's conditions. Trotsky in 1938 writes that it's impossible for the productive forces to be developed. His transitional program is called the death agony of capitalism. 70 odd years later.
Actually, he acknowledged that.
But what I'm saying is he's addressing a certain world, as is the First World Congress. There are lessons there that must be crystallized and taken forward, but we live in a period that is premised on enormous defeat. So I think the question you have to take seriously as an organization, to call yourselves Bolsheviks and Leninists, is why do you draw a distinction between the internal discussion and normal, healthy functioning in Leninism, Bolshevism, and that crystallized experience. It's not about the size of the organization, it's about the organizational norms that these people embodied and fought for. And that's why it is, you do have a tendency, this is on the loyalty to the organization over the loyalty to the working class and politics, right? Is this these regimes where the only choice you have, you say, oh, you get frustrated because you want to break with something after 10 years, I agree, but if that's the only choice you have, then we can't build anything as a left. We can't rebuild the working class movement. If the only choice we have is the organisation of norms is to say, right, we can only go public if we split. That is not Leninism. It's a caricature.
Within the party, to correct the line.
But that's not Leninism, as we know, commonly.
And you don't know which faction I'm in and which faction.
Well, exactly, and that's actually lying.
So you can't influence our internal discussion,
exactly,
which is what we want.
And that is lying.
We don't want to talk to
you. That is actually presenting some kind of face to the working class, which is lying. Sorry.
Order in the court.
So let's have crystallized the
difference.
You want to lie to the working class?
Let's have the final answer, and then I think that will be the kind of belligerent talk in the blog.
Or beer.
To set up the belligerent talk in the blog, I would just say in response to Ben, that the point I was making is that it's a function of the needs of the organization at the time and how best to advance the revolutionary program. I think actually the picture you draw of Lenin's explanation of what is democratic centralism is actually overdrawn and actually doesn't look at what he said at other times as well. I think that was a function of the concrete circumstances that he faced at a particular moment. So that's what I was trying to say. I wasn't trying to do a Mandel type or justification. And maybe I'll include it on that and then we can argue about this other problem.
That's great. Well, thank you, everyone. Let's give Josh a big round of applause. As Cam said, where I think most people are convening going to a bar called Exeter.